Greetings, dear Dharma friends. I am very pleased to be able to share on this occasion the recording of a talk and commentary on the Anattalakkhana Sutta that I gave while leading a pilgrimage in India recently. I just wanted to mention that every now and then there's a little bit of a muffled noise, literally lasts just for a few seconds. This is from when a breeze was blowing against the sensitive microphones on the recorder. It literally lasts just a few seconds and then things are audible again. So please do persevere. Understand that when recording on the road, as it were, sometimes these things happen. I believe the content is worth listening to, and I hope that you find something in the sharing of benefit to you. I hope your understanding and your practice. Be well. Yesterday, we went through the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which we've now chanted three times. In this vicinity, the place where it was taught, covering the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. Dukkha is to be known. Lord Buddha understood it, knew it. Cause of dukkha, craving on the foundation of ignorance, is to be abandoned. The truth of the cessation of all suffering is to be realized. Lord Buddha realized it. It's to be realized through cultivating the Eightfold Path. Lord Buddha had cultivated it. While giving the teaching, explaining the middle way, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, Anya Kondanya attained to the first level of enlightenment, which was when the Sangha was officially born in the world. And the Dhamma, in terms of a code of teachings, was also officially born in the world on that occasion with the first sermon now taught. In the following days, Lord Buddha taught the Anattalakkhana Sutta. On that occasion, all five of the Panchavaki, as they're called, became arahants, the five samanas who had been the companions of the Bodhisattva when he was striving with his austere practice. Then the Blessed One taught and instructed the rest of the bhikkhus with a talk on the Dhamma. As he did so, there arose in the Venerable Wappa and the Venerable Bhadiya the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. They too asked for and received the full admission. Then, living on the food they brought to him, the Blessed One taught and instructed the rest of the bhikkhus with talk on the Dhamma. All six lived on the food brought back by three of them. Then there arose in the Venerable Mahanama and the Venerable Asaji the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma, and they too asked for and received the full admission. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. So they were having some Dhamma discussions. Many of them attained to stream entry, and then Lord Buddha taught the discourse on not self, which we chanted this morning. Thus have I heard, at one time the Blessed One was dwelling at Banaras in the deer park. There he addressed the group of five bhikkhus. Form bhikkhus is not self. If bhikkhus form were self, then form would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to form, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. But since bhikkhus form is not self, form therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to form, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. So I'll just read through the first part and then I'll make a few comments. Feeling is not self. If bhikkhus feeling were self, feeling would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to feeling, let my feeling be thus, let my feeling not be thus. But since bhikkhus feeling is not self, feeling therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to feeling, let my feeling be thus, let my feeling not be thus. Perception is not self. If bhikkhus perception were self, perception would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to perception, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus. But since bhikkhus perception is not self, perception therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to perception, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus. Mental formations are not self. If bhikkhus mental formations were self, mental formations would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to mental formations, Let my mental formations be thus. Let my mental formations not be thus. But since bhikkhus, mental formations are not self, mental formations therefore lead to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to mental formations, let my mental formations be thus, let my mental formations not be thus. Lastly, consciousness is not self. If bhikkhus consciousness were self, consciousness would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to consciousness, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness not be thus. But since bhikkhus consciousness is not self, consciousness therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to consciousness, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness not be thus. So when Lord Buddha addresses the bhikkhus in this way, when we think about it, it's kind of obvious. But what is very, very curious about the unenlightened state is that we don't think about it. So this is where we have the problem, the challenge of the worldly being. It seems that we're born with this tendency to grasp at things as being a self. And so with our parents, mum being who she is and dad being who he is, and mum being the way she is and dad being the way they are, and your teacher being the way they are, and everybody interpreting their experience. So when you have a pain, mum, my belly aches, dad, I fell over, it hurts. It's the way we interpret. So basically, we do assume that the body is a self. And when Lord Buddha asks them to investigate, well, do you have any control over it? Can you stop it aging? Can you make it be younger? Once it's sick, can you will it to be healthy? And if you really think about it, okay, there is this phenomena of a body that we all have. We have to kind of nominally live with it and steward its healthy functioning, but we actually have quite not much control over what actually happens with it. It will grow. If we don't want it to, it will grow. It will age, even if we don't want it to. We might take care of our health impeccably, and it's still going to get sick. And we might not want to die. Last night we were on the burning ghats. Must have been about 15 or 20 bodies burning around us. So between 200 and 300 bodies per day being burnt on the burning ghats. So some of those people would have been old and probably would have felt like it's ready to time to go. Many of those people might not have known that they were going to die the day that they died. The Hindu tradition is to burn the body within 24 hours, so all of those bodies were recently dead. So when we consider it, and this is the thing, Lord, but this is the thing about a Buddha, a teaching Buddha who has had liberating insight, who has the benefit of not being affected by ignorance and delusion anymore, is he can state something which is quite obvious, that we would literally never work out unless he stated it. Because we have assumptions. This is the thing about ignorance. Ignorance is not knowing. Delusion is misapprehending. The reason we don't recognize the truth is we are deluded. So that's it's a really important thing to understand, because we need to recognize the power of this. Greed, hatred, and delusion. So we understand greed. We understand that having a lot of greed isn't good. It causes us and others suffering. We can also see that aversion, anger, irritation, hatred isn't good. We cause ourselves stress. We upset people around us. But the delusion thing, we don't actually give that much thought, and we need to, because it's the root of the problem. Perceiving the body, perceiving feelings as a self, and then that whole thing, once we've done that, the whole calamity unfolds. Because when you think you're a body and you think you're your feelings, then you have this whole spectrum of the things that you would like to experience and the things that you would not like to experience. And when you get the things that you like to experience, you're happy for a while. When you don't get the things that you're not happy to experience, that you don't want to experience, you have irritation. There's that wonderful phrase we chant so often, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. This is part of the characteristic of dukkha. Once you think you're a self, that's part of your inheritance that comes with the package. So Lord Buddha, I mean, just even thinking about the Hindus last night, while it's fresh in our mind, going and seeing the aarti on the banks of the Ganges, a kind of a Brahman puja that's been occurring for thousands of years in honor of the goddess of the Ganges River. and in honor to Shiva, and this belief that the burning ghat where we were, one of the reasons it's considered sacred is because the Hindus believe that Shiva was once there and he left his earring there. So if you have a theistic worldview, if you believe in an all-powerful creator God that has power over everything, then the fact that that all-powerful God left his earring somewhere has incredible importance. It's been sanctified. They also believe that the Ganges River is literally running out of the hair of Shiva. So if you get your ashes sprinkled into that river, then you get to go and live with Shiva in the Brahma realm. But the whole interpretation, if you're an evolved spiritual person, you're still thinking in terms of self and other. You understand that this self-view is limited and causing suffering. So you're going to pray to a big, beautiful self in the sky. And then you assume that you can fuse with that. You can become one with Godhead. So Lord Buddha here is talking about anatta. And a lot of the Hindu tradition, the Vedic tradition, is actually becoming one with the supreme self, or realizing your deeper self, actualizing true self. It's all self. There's this assumption that, okay, this self is limited. So all I need to do is get my samadhi together and pray to God, and I can fuse with that self, which is unlimited. The problem is, as Lord Buddha explains to us, there are many, many suttas where he talks about the passing of devas and deities from that state. So even gods, unfortunately, or actually fortunately, even gods don't get to stay in a permanent state in heaven. So we would call them deities. We wouldn't really see them as gods. So I do believe they exist. Deities exist due to previous karma, probably as human beings. People with amazing samadhi, incredible generosity, cultivate a lot of virtue, get born in very illustrious, radiant states where they have a lot of power. Having given power to others, having given wealth to others, having given opportunity to others, and they receive a similar benefit. But every life, every form ends. All that is of the nature to arise has the nature to cease. So Lord Buddha is teaching to something superior that he realized himself. And the way he's doing it here is he's addressing the ignorance and delusion. And what happens is when the ignorance and delusion falls away, what remains, clarity, presence of mind, mindfulness with clear comprehension, that penetrates into seeing things the way they are. But without Lord Buddha pointing to that, we wouldn't work it out. So we're very lucky. He's like a physician that says, this is the illness. Stop doing these things. That feeds the illness. And start paying attention here. When we don't feed the ignorance, when we don't feed the delusion, we cultivate a lot of mindfulness, clear seeing arises. Ignorance and delusion, the power of ignorance and delusion is weakened, and clear seeing arises. So you can see these spiritual warriors who were capable of the most incredible feats, probably had quite remarkable samadhi too. And the next big teaching, the discourse on the fire sermon, many of those fire-worshipping ascetics would have had amazing samadhi. But without this pointing to the fact that it's not a self, to pointing to the fact that we're doing something with this phenomena, we're doing something with the body, we're doing something with our feelings, we're doing something with our mental formations, we're doing something with our perceptions, we're doing something with our consciousness. What are we doing with it? We're perceiving it as a self. We're interpreting it as a self. And then when you really have a look at it, one at a time, with some investigative discipline, we have a look at, hey, look, it's not. I don't have much control over my body. So then he instructs further. What do you think about this bhikkhu? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this is myself? It is not, Lord. What do you think about this bhikkhu? Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this is myself? It is not, Lord. Well, what do you think about this, bhikkhus? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this, this is myself? It is not, Lord. What do you think about this, bhikkhus? Are mental formations permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this, this is myself? It is not, Lord. What do you think about this, bhikkhus? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this, this is myself? It is not, Lord. So now Lord Buddha gives instruction. So challenging once again, just asking them, does it make any sense to perceive this, to interpret this, to call this a self? No, it doesn't. And then basically, so don't do that. Wherefore, bhikkhus, whatever form there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether it is far or near, all form should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it really is thus. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. So this is really important when it comes to any ultimate truth, which is logical, rational, scientific in nature. It applies to all forms. Just as your form, just as the bhikkhu's forms is not self, Lord Buddha is saying, in the past it wasn't, in the future it won't be. Other people's also, forms inside, forms outside, no matter how gross, no matter how subtle, inferior or superior, whatever form, regardless of how people are deludedly seeing it, the fact is, this is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. Whatever feeling there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether it is far or near, all feeling should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it really is thus. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. Whatever perception there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether it is far or near, all feeling should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it really is, thus, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Whatever mental formations there are, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether they are far or near, all mental formations should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as they really are. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. And lastly, whatever consciousness there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether far or near, all consciousness should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it really is thus. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. So our thoughts, this habit that we have of identifying with our thoughts. And sometimes it's easier to observe things in other people. It's like, why would you think that? Or someone has a bad habit, or they're a nice person but they hate themselves, and it's just like, that's just weird. Why do you do that to yourself? Or somebody's putting forth a really sincere effort, but they're judging themselves for it, and you can look on onwardly saying, it's okay, you're making a good effort, just keep making the effort, but they're really down on themselves. And you can see this all the time. But it's the same with us. It's our thoughts, our habits, our neuroses. It's not a self either. Seeing in this way, bhikkhus, the wise noble disciple becomes disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with mental formations, disenchanted with consciousness. Becoming disenchanted, their passions fade away. With the fading of passion, the heart is liberated. With liberation there comes the knowledge, it is liberated and they know. Destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived out, done is what had to be done, there is no more coming into any state of being. So this is one of the most amazing paragraphs in the whole Sutta Pitaka, 84,000 Dhamma verses. This is one amazing verse. How to get enlightened in one paragraph. become disenchanted with form. So it's an interesting word to consider, and sometimes the translation, I would translate it slightly differently. Nipita is weary. So becoming weary of something, when you recognize that something is burdensome to hang on to, the misidentification, the deluded grasping hurts, it's dukkha. When you see that very, very clearly, you become weary of it. And the mind becomes oriented in a different way. It's turning inward, because grasping at things outwardly in that way is painful. So one becomes weary. And this is actually a spiritual emotion. It's not I'm completely fed up with my body, I'm completely fed up with my feelings. It's not based in aversion. This is very important to understand. This kind of spiritual disenchantment is the result of a lot of meditation. By seeing clearly, gosh, it really isn't a self, but I keep interpreting it that way and it's really painful, then the mind is trying to find somewhere where it can rest. It's trying to find something else that isn't painful, but it's not fascinated anymore. That's another way I like to consider that word. Becoming disenchanted means not being fascinated with anymore, not being committed to trying to squeeze pleasure out of it. That was part of the Buddha's insight under the Bodhi tree, was the grasping that beings, the part of the cause of birth, was grasping at the five khandhas because of the attachment to the pleasure that can be gained within them, from them. The danger is the fact that the pleasure is fleeting and it always comes with a lot of pain surrounding it. And even when the pleasure changes, that's painful. Then there's painful experience and there's aging. So Lord Buddha would talk about knowing the pleasure. Again, similar with this, the cause of dukkha is to be known. Dukkha is to be known. One knows the pleasure. What is it? What is it that I'm attached to? What is it that I get out of this exchange? But then he said, see the danger. Okay, because I'm attached to birth, because I'm attached to pleasant sensual feelings that I can see, nice sights, nice sounds, nice touches, nice tastes, nice pleasant feelings with the body, what else comes with that? Unpleasant sights, unpleasant sounds, unpleasant tastes, unpleasant touches. And with youth and vitality and the joy of all of that comes aging, comes illness, comes death. So this is the danger. Basically, it's not worth it. It's not a good bargain. It's not a good deal. Then the next phrase he would say is cultivate the escape. So that's the Eightfold Path. See the pleasure. Understand that's what I'm attached to. See the danger. Attaching to the pleasure, you get the pain, lots of it, until you do something about it, birth after birth after birth after birth, and then cultivate the escape. The good news is that there is an escape. That's the wonderful news. So because the five bhikkhus were very developed in their spiritual faculties, once this deluded habit of perceiving things as a self was pointed out to them, and Lord Buddha challenged them, don't perceive it as a self. See it this way. It's not mine. I'm not this. This is not myself. Interesting to notice in this that he's not defining anything that they are. He's not saying this is not mine. I'm not this. This is not myself. But this is you. Again, I'm trying to point here to the fact that your enlightenment potential or your Buddha nature, that's already there in all of us. This is part of having the conscious situation of a human being. All that really needs to occur is the deluded grasping at things as being other than they are. That has to be let go of. That takes discipline, because our habit at deluded grasping is very deep. It's millions of lifetimes deep. But essentially, that's all we have to do. We have to stop misapprehending it and see it clearly for what it is. Then what we call enlightenment takes care of itself. Enlightenment isn't the self getting anything. Enlightenment is, sometimes the phrase is used, relinquishment. It's what you actually gave up. Gave up perceiving it as me and mine. Gave up being committed to trying to squeeze as much pleasure out of it as possible. Just allowed it to be as it was, as it is, with clear knowing that sees things as they are. This is not mine. This is not myself. And so thus spoke the Blessed One. Delighted, the group of five bhikkhus rejoiced in what the Lord Buddha had said. Moreover, while this discourse was being delivered, the minds of the five bhikkhus were freed from the defilements through clinging no more. Thus ends the discourse on the characteristic of not self. So looking at this paragraph again, the wise, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with mental formations, disenchanted with consciousness. Becoming disenchanted, their passions fade away. So passion, the types of lusts and craving that we have. So if you're not fascinated with the forms anymore, what is there to crave? This is the thing about not being fascinated. If you see it for what it is, when you understand the amount of pleasure that's available, when you understand that that pleasure is fleeting, when you understand that there's more suffering than pleasure, if you really can see that, are you going to hanker after these things? If we can just see them truly, accurately, correctly, as they are, it's not worth lusting after that, because we know it causes much, much, much more suffering than it causes pleasure and causes rebirth, conditions further craving. So just not doing that, just not doing that with regards forms, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and different types of consciousness, passions fade away. With the fading of passion, the heart is liberated. With the liberation, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated, and they know, destroyed is birth. The holy life has been lived out. Done is what had to be done. There is no more coming into any state of being. So Lord Buddha says that when he had his own enlightenment experience, he knew that this is my last birth. There's the other interesting, after Lord Buddha was enlightened and he considered not teaching for a period of time, he made this interesting, he said this interesting paragraph. Men died in lust, and whom a cloud of darkness laps, will never see. What goes against the stream is subtle, deep, and hard to see. So that's the problem. Men died in lust. Again, we're talking about passions and craving. So it's our commitment, a commitment to trying to experience pleasant things and avoid unpleasant things. That's a stain in the mind, that's a cloud of darkness laps around us. So that's the ignorance and the delusion, our commitment to seeing things in this way. So his teaching on not self, the teaching on not trying to fulfill craving. Today is the day that the Owadapatimokkha was taught, over 2,500 years ago. That's the beginning of the tradition of laying down the code of discipline, the ethical conduct for the monks. And some of the lines in that verse are very instructive. Might even look at it since it is Magga Puja Day. Let's have a look at that. Page 60. Many of these we'll be familiar with because you learn it as part of the Dhammapada. This is the... In the beginning, Lord Buddha didn't lay down the actual rules because the monks weren't actually breaking rules yet. They were of a very, very high standard. But he laid down a set of principles. And so Lord Buddha refers to his own teaching as Dhamma and Vinaya. He never refers to it as just Dhamma. This is very important. Dhamma and Vinaya. The truth and the discipline. They go together. You have to have a discipline in your meditation. You have to have discipline in your ethical behavior or you won't realize the truth. So they do go together. You need the Dhamma and the discipline. Not doing any evil, to be committed to the good, purifying one's mind. These are the teachings of all Buddhas. Patient endurance is the highest practice, burning out defilements. So that was the one I wanted to point to. In Thai, it's the... Patient endurance is the supreme incinerator of defilements. Kwam ot glan bin kreung pao kilet yang ying. So it's... we need the Buddha to explain this to us. And we need people who have patiently endured and had got the results from the patient endurance. Because during the process, if you're not yet at the stage of the five disciples, and you didn't get enlightened while I was reading through that, there's a process of having to patiently endure with the craving. So craving swells up in the mind, just as we were reading the other paragraph that Lord Buddha said. Minds are dyed in lust. It's a lot of there's a lot of lust in there. And so what happens is the craving energy, because of past, previously acting on it, whenever we do that without mindfulness, act on our passions, they'll be coming back again. We feed them as a karmic formation, as a karmic tendency, and it's that same energy, that same desire swells up in the mind again. When the pressure builds up, we'll feel like we have to do it again. It's really not very different to a drug addict. You need the fix because you don't want to deal with the withdrawal symptoms. The Lord Buddha is saying, patiently enduring with this energy of craving is what incinerates the defilements, defilements being negative qualities which darken the mind. So that's unpleasant. That's an unpleasant experience. But one has to, when one commits to it by keeping the five precepts strictly, you'll notice the desire to do something that you can't do because it's against the precepts comes up, but you can't do it. And there's some friction, there's some irritation. What you will notice after a period of time, however, after 6 months, after a year, after a few years, is you'll notice that the level of the desire and the power of the desire is less. And something that you thought was that you really, really had to do and it was really, really hard to give up, you suddenly find that you hardly ever want to do it anymore because you see the benefit of not doing it. But this is where we need Lord Buddha to explain this. So what has occurred in that process is through not feeding the craving, through patiently enduring with the desire without acting on it, the power of that defilement in the mind is getting thinner and thinner and weakening and weakening. And you can imagine how little these five disciples had, given that they were the companion of the Buddha during the 6 years where he was eating a half a palmful of rice. Obviously, these spiritual warriors were accustomed to patiently enduring with desire, with a lot of patience. And so the Buddha says Nibbana is supreme. And that's important too. And what is Nibbana? In a culture that believed that either Brahma or Shiva, the creator God, is supreme, the Lord Buddha is saying, no, Nibbana is supreme. Well, what's Nibbana? Well, Nibbana is not self. There's no God there. And God can't help you to realize it. So one has to actually have faith in this. Is it a state? It's a realization. A realization. It's what's left when greed, hatred, and delusion falls away from the mind. A purified mind. Lord Buddha does say that it's unshakable peace. When he does say words, he's very careful not to define it as a thing, because he knows we have this habit and tendency of grasping at concepts and grasping at ideas and then misinterpreting them. So he seems to be reluctant to define it, but what he does say is that it's deathless, nothing there can die, it's unshakable peace, it is attainable by those who strive rightly and correctly, to be experienced individually by the wise, is one of the praises of the... So it's not just the Brahman, you don't have to be born into a high caste to realize Nibbana, people from every caste, when they practice correctly, according to the Eightfold Path, realize Nibbana. Men and women, humans and devas. So it's something that is achievable, but isn't an achievement. I keep pointing to the fact that it's actually a relinquishment. But we have to be consistent in our practices so that our spiritual faculties have the power to be able to relinquish what needs to be relinquished. The greed, the hatred, and the delusion, the ignorance. So it's the five precepts, eight precepts for when you do retreats or on the lunar observance days, the daily meditation, that is the path. Listening to teachings which will always be pointing to anicchang, impermanence, dukkhang, unsatisfactoriness of conditions, and anatta, the not self characteristic. And we just chip away. So what we can't see in this, of course, is how many thousands of lives the five disciples had put in before they appeared to suddenly attain arahantship in this very place, quite quickly. But we can be sure that it was a long time. We don't know, of course, how much we have practiced, so hopefully we've done quite a bit of practice in the past. But whether we have or we haven't, what remains is the practice we have to do, however much or however long that is. So let's finish this since we got halfway through. Buddhists say Nibbana is supreme. The next thing is about the harmlessness. Not a renunciant is one who injures others. Whoever troubles others can't be called a monk. Not to insult and not to injure. To live restrained by training rules. Knowing one's measure at the meal, so knowing the right amount. Retreating to a lonely place, a secluded place. Devotion to the higher mind. These are the teachings of all Buddhas. So this is a very beautiful short teaching which points, it's a very pithy pointing to the heart of what Buddhas teach. And it's always good to check that. If there are any teachers saying something that's not in accordance with that, then you should notice and choose one that says things in accordance with this. So I'd like to spend a bit more time meditating as well, so I offer this for your reflection.
Sad.